The following is a message from George Trujillo, a data strategist at DataStax. As a reminder, DataStax is the only financial sponsor of Data Mesh Radio and the Data Mesh Learning community at this time. I work with George, and I would highly recommend speaking with him. It's always a fun conversation.
One of the key value propositions of a data mesh is empowering lines of business to innovate with data. So it's been really exciting for me personally to see data mesh in practice and how it's maturing. This is a significant organizational transformation, so it must be well understood. Empowering developers, analysts, and data scientists with downstream data has been part of my personal data journey that reemphasized the importance of reducing complexity in real-time data ecosystems and the criticality of picking the right real-time data technology stack. I'm always open and welcome the opportunity to share experiences and ideas around executing a data mesh strategy. Feel free to email or connect with me on LinkedIn if you'd like to talk about real-time data ecosystems, data management strategies, or data mesh. The contact information can be found in the notes below. Thank you.
A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Hurlman, sponsored by Starburst. This is Adrian Estala, VP and Field CDO at Starburst, and host of Data Mesh TV. Starburst is the leading contributor to Trino, the open source project, and the Data Mesh for Dummies book that I co-wrote with Colleen Tarto and Andy Mott. To claim your free book, head over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio, a part of the Data as a Product podcast network, is a free community resource provided by DataStax. Data Mesh Radio is produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the co-founder of the Data Mesh Learning community. This podcast is designed to help you get up to speed on a number of data mesh related topics. Hopefully, you find it useful. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in today's episode? I interviewed Jean-Georges Perrin, aka JGP, the intelligence platform lead at PayPal. JGP is probably the first guest to really lean into using data quantum instead of data product when talking about a lot of things. So it's an interesting conversation, even if just from that point of view. So some key takeaways or thoughts from JGP's point of view. Data mesh, as it's been laid out by Jamak, obviously leaves a lot of room for innovation. For some, that's great. For others, they want a blueprint, right? And it's okay to wait for people to really put together a little bit more of those blueprints. And, you know, I think it'll always be impossible to completely copy paste, but it's okay for others to wait. But JGP and his team are excited to be part of that innovation. I know a lot of you out there as well are excited about innovation. Number two, PayPal's three main initial target outcomes from their data mesh implementation: A, faster and easier data discovery; B, easier to use the data in a governed way; and C, increased data consumer trust in the data. And their first consumers are all just data scientists. They're not going super wide with their data consumers up front. Number three, really consider what you want to prove out in your MVP. Is that a minimum viable data quantum, data platform, data mesh, something else? You know, only doing a data quantum probably sets you up for trouble, and a platform only won't be tested until it has data quanta or data products on it, right? Number four, data contracts are crucial to making trustability actually measurable and agreed upon. Otherwise, it's far too easy to have miscommunication between data producers and consumers, which leads to a lack and or loss of trust. Number five, producers, don't set your data contract terms too strictly for yourself when first launching a data quantum, right? There's no need to over-engineer, despite how interesting that can sometimes be. Number six, for too long, in general, we have tried to keep software engineering and data engineering overly separate. They're both just kind of engineering. You know, Emily Gorsinski talked a lot about this. Jumak has talked about this. They're just kind of engineering with slightly different focus. And data mesh really leans into trying to do away with those distinctions in the long run. Number seven, we've also tried to keep operational and analytical far too separate. We should look to build out tooling where data can live that serves both operational and analytical workload needs, those HTAP or hybrid transactional analytical processing type systems. But we aren't there yet. And again, this is in JGB's opinion. I think this is something that would be great, but it's also kind of intentionality around do you want systems that end up being kind of okay at either, or do you want something that's good at one or the other. Number eight, analytical APIs, at least as far as we've seen them to date, are just not going to do what we need relative to accessing data from data products or Quanta, according to JGP. Number nine, standardizing metadata access APIs across Data Quanta has made it very simple for data consumers to begin using new Data Quanta as they're introduced to the mesh at PayPal. PayPal has observability, discovery, and control APIs, and they're standardized across all of their data quants or data products. Number 10, domain is an overloaded word. It can mean a very large, high-level domain like sales or finance or HR or marketing with hundreds or thousands of people in it, or it can mean a smaller, two pizza team level scale. Be pretty specific when you're talking internally about what you mean by what domain actually means. Number 11, it's crucial to understand data quanta and the use cases they power both have different life cycles. So really apply product thinking. It's going to be really crucial. Finally, number 12, most data engineering teams do work in a waterfall approach. And that just doesn't scale that well relative to what we're trying to do with something like data mesh. Moving to data mesh can mean additional cognitive load, as it really requires moving to that agile. And so changing those ways of working for data engineers is non-trivial. Be aware of that. Be empathetic to that. With that bottom line up front done, let's jump into the interview. Okay, very, very excited for today's episode. I've got Jean-Georges Perrin, who is the intelligence platform lead at PayPal, and he goes by JGP, so that's what we'll be seeing from here on in the episode. Very excited about this, specifically for a couple of different aspects. One is he very recently, relative to when we're recording, but not probably as recently as to when you're listening, but put out a great blog post about kind of the early journey around data mesh at PayPal, and especially really digging into what is a data quanta. Right? Like, what does that actually mean? And a little bit of difference, I've talked about this a little bit, but data product has connotations around it, right? And we need to think about data as a product and what we're actually creating of these data products, or the data quantum is probably a better way to differentiate it than all the other definitions of data product, right? There's so many of these things. And then we're also going to be talking about analytical APIs and kind of how they're different from regular APIs and even kind of data APIs, and how we really need to figure out how to do these in a much better way. I think we've, as an industry, the more people that I dig into speaking about these analytical APIs, they're very, very difficult to do when not many people are doing them well, especially versioning. And when you think about like semantic versioning and things like that, it gets even more complicated. So excited to dig into a lot of these topics. But before we jump into that, JGP, if you don't mind giving people a bit of an introduction to yourself, and then we can jump into the conversation at hand.
Yeah, sure, Scott. So first, I'm super excited to be on the show today. You've been my mowing buddy for the entire summer, where I'm listening to the podcast a little bit on the faster side, but I've got a lot to mow, so I know the insider tricks of all everything you're saying. But having said that, yeah, so I'm Jean-Georges Perrin, or JGP. I work at PayPal, but for the last 15 years, I've been building data platforms, and I would admit that even some of them went to production. And prior 8 years to that, I was mostly focusing on development tools. So you can see how tainted I am on some aspects. Another thing is culturally I always had a trouble opposing data engineering to software engineering. I think it's a little bit ridiculous to oppose that. So I'm in the teams I'm leading right now. We're blending all that, and we're having a very considerate part for both engineering domains. So, yep. Yeah, in a nutshell, that's it.
Okay. I think that sets up the conversation very, very well, especially starting off the conversation about kind of what you've learned in your early journey and what you're interacting with, especially about that software engineering and data engineering, about how you can make it so that the software engineers can understand what they've got to do. And we don't have to have this kind of hard separation, but also like, how are you managing that cognitive load? So huge topic. I'll give you kind of a useful place to kind of start with that. So in your blog post, you covered a lot about the data quantum and how you're kind of really thinking about it at the quantum level how that then plays into the mesh. So if you can start to talk about how you've talked to your teams about, we're going to build this data quantum. What is the point of it? What are we actually trying to achieve with this? What are we trying to achieve in the version 1 or version 0.1? Or like what is necessary? What can we leave a little bit for later? I'm trying to give people a little bit of permission to move forward without being like, we have absolutely everything done, everything nailed, all of that. So you could give some background there. That'd be helpful.
So first, I love to compare the data mesh, and maybe I'm wrong, but I love to compare the data mesh to Agile. Okay, so when Agile came up, everybody was kind of, hey, I'm doing waterfall, I'm great at it. And the thing is, then Agile came in and we changed the paradigm of things. So when I'm seeing data engineering teams, and not specifically at PayPal, but in my career, I've seen a lot of those data engineering being very waterfallish in their way of working. Okay, and it's not a bad thing. Okay, it's not because you're doing waterfalls that you're evil. Okay, it's not always a line of, oh, we do software. So when we started this process, we were already doing Agile quite a bit, and it made sense. It was not an extra cognitive load on the team, you know, to assume that, oh, we're changing the methodology from waterfall to Agile, and then we're also changing this from, I would say, data warehousing to data mesh. Okay. I think people were aware of the challenges and what we wanted to achieve. And this created this kind of, you know, it's this appetite for experimenting with something new. And that's how we started with the data mesh. Okay. And so I love a lot of the things about the data mesh and what I've read in Jama's book and her videos and articles. The only thing I'm disagreeing with her is that it's not revolutionary for me. It's evolutionary. So it was really about, when you think about training people and explaining to people, is really about showing them the evolution from their current jobs. And it made things a lot easier. So that's on the cognitive load, I would say.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, not to speak on Jamak's behalf, but I think it is revolutionary in that where you are versus where your picture is of 6 years down the road. But the only way to get there is via evolution. It is to say, like, we're going to be evolving, and it's not you have to go from point A to point Z. You know, you have to do this big bang approach, and it's like we're going to change. And the way that we do data mesh, you know, Jamak has talked about she wishes she had 5 years to wait until she wrote her V1 of her book, because it's so much like we don't know how we do this very well, right? We're still
And I think that's great as well, okay? Because it leaves a lot of room for innovation, okay? So, and rather than being, you know, stuck in a concept which you don't control, you know. And I'm both French and American, and the French people have a very special relationship with revolutions. So, you know, I'm using the word very, very carefully. Anyway, so the thing is, in this, you know, agile way of doing things, we wanted to create an MVP, okay? So really trying, we've got this proof of concept and an MVP, and then you can, you know, you've got a product, okay? Your data mesh as itself is a product. But what's your MVP? What's a minimum thing you can deliver that is actually bringing value? And that's where we settle on the quantum. We say, well, if we deliver a quantum to our customers, data scientists, business analysts, we're already delivering kind of quite some value, right? And and then when we mesh them together, it should bring even more value, like 1 + 1 = 3 kind of value, right? So that's why we decided, okay, let's build a very efficient quantum, and I think that's what we did.
And so I've had this question a couple of times around your proof of concept, your minimum viable, like, what are you actually trying to prove out? Were you trying to prove out that you could build the quantum and that the quantum could provide value and it had like stable value versus like when people do data services, it has often it has value up front, but then the sustainability isn't there. Were you trying to prove out you could do the mesh? Because then there's minimum viable mesh. Like what were you trying to prove out?
So what we wanted to prove is, so PayPal has been a pioneer in data self-service. Okay. So this is not what when we look at the four principle, okay. So the principle of self-serve data platform is if I came to my leadership saying, hey, we're going to do self-serve data platforms, they would probably laugh at me. Okay. So we have that. Okay. So, but it's more really about ownership and about the federated computational governance as well. Okay. So what we want to enable our data scientists is faster and easier data discovery. Okay. This is where we've seen that a lot of our folks are using some time. As you can imagine, we've got a bit of data in this company, and so we want to make sure that it's used and it's when it's used it's governed. Okay. So that's really what we wanted to prove out through our first quantum. Okay. So and give and bring trusted data to our data scientists. We want to make sure that when they connect to the quantum, they have a real grasp of whether it's the right data for the use case. Okay, so they can access, you know, data contracts, they can access the observability, they can access, of course, a dictionary. So all those things were really targeted towards creating a great user experience for our data scientists.
And when you say governed, I just had Nicola Askham on, and so she's the data governance coach. And she kind of brought up this topic around what is actually being governed mean, right? Like governance is often thought of as, you know, access control and like, do you have the right to use it? And is this going to get us in trouble? Is this non-compliant use? Versus a lot of what you talked about also falls under governance, or it should, of is this, you know, the understandability, is this the right data? Like, how can I discover the data? A lot of that needs to be at more the governance level rather than each individual data product needs to have that discoverability, right? Each data quantum, yep. But it can't be that every single one has a different way of discovering and understanding its quality metrics and all of that, because then you have a different data quantum user experience every single one, and so you have to learn.
So that that's I think one of the benefit of having the quantum is that we standardize the APIs, okay, and that's what I think that was kind of the key thing there. You know, because a lot of people say, oh, but, you know, when you're accessing metadata, you can access metadata on an Oracle database or an Informix database or DB2 database. Yeah, but it's all different, okay? It's not like it's always completely different, but then you've got different data stores and then it's completely different and got complete user experience with a learning curve, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so here we partner with our enterprise data governance team. Okay, so it's not like we're doing that in a silo. We're really following the idea of they giving us policies, they're giving us best practices, they're giving us what they want to see from an enterprise governance level, and the quantum is following those direction. Okay. So when the data scientist, the consumer access individual quantum is not, or she's not really, you know, it's the same experience, right? You're making the same calls. You've got the same, global user experience in that. So, and when we're talking about APIs, of course, you can think about, you know, microservices and REST APIs, but it's also about APIs, I would say, in the stricter or historical terms, as everything is available through Python APIs. Okay, so our data scientists they dream notebooks. Okay, they want Jupyter everywhere. They think Jupyter is the source of all goodness in the world. So it was only natural for us to make sure that each quantum is accessible via, you know, this a Python API directly in the notebook. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've got like seven different question directions there. Sure. But I did want to tie this in. You've listened, so you know my 17-point question. But one thing I wanted to tie in was right now your users are the data scientists, and so the mm-hmm. Python API is fine. When you start to think about what people are talking about with marketplaces and things like that of lowering the bar, I would love to hear about where your, you know, so that more people can access this. It's not just data scientists. You can get the data analysts or even the people in the business side. So I want to explore that of kind of what's the future hold there. But I also want to talk about kind of chicken and egg. What came first? You know, did you build a data quantum and then you said, okay, we're going to standardize the API around this, or did you standardize your API first? And then also, do you want to open source that, or do you want to share that with folks so they can see like how you're doing your API so that you have that standardized? Because people are really struggling with doing that. But like, what I think that's a more interesting thing to start with of like, how did you approach this of, instead of, is this a one-off, but you are thinking about like a kind of cordoned off MVP, was it to get to a quantum and then you go, we're going to give you the access layer a little later once we've built a couple of these, then we can start to standardize around that, or like just...
We work in parallel. Okay, so there's nobody in my career that gave me something like, hey, here's your $20 million and have fun with it, okay, and come back in 2 years with something. So in our scenario, we still have to deliver stuff, right? And it sounds like it's a problem when I'm saying it, but I think it's actually a good thing, is because if you don't have regular deliveries, well, you don't get feedback, right? So you can create, and then you're going back to waterfall in some way. So the way we approach this is we are delivering data products, okay? But data products, the old way of saying, hey, this is a data product, and because it's a data product, you've got all these fields, you've got all this documentation that comes with it. It's a data product, okay? It's not a data product as the mesh would provide, but it's that. So we're delivering that, and we're adding features, which are the quantum features on top of that. So it was from the beginning, we really had the idea of, okay, we're going to deliver, we've got teams delivering data products, okay? And we've got a team building the platform and building the tools that are coming with the data products, okay? So, and of course, it means that the data products have as its life cycle, but the sidecar, okay, the data quantum as a sidecar has also its life cycle. So right now we're at, I would say, POC V2 level, okay? MVP is targeted probably when people will listen to this podcast. We're constantly delivering additional value, and we've got teams that are delivering value on top of it. So you have not the luxury. You must be tied to standardization, right? I cannot have different APIs over time. I cannot have different REST APIs or Python APIs. As a behavior over time will evolve, but the principle should stay the same. And the way we are deploying that is based on DevOps methodology. So it means that we're delivering, and we're sharing as it goes. Okay, so it's a completely CI/CD and all what you would expect from a modern software engineering practice.
And I think going back to what you're talking about of what is a data product in what you were mm-hmm. talking about there, it's a product that's powered by data, correct? And that the data quantum is an underlying component of making it so that that's possible, right? It's not that the data product and what you were talking about is the actual data itself in most cases or all cases, because the data quantum is the thing of the data itself. Is that correct?
Yeah, so you can see it as an evolution. Okay, we've got data products without the quantum. We've got data products which are coming with quantum, and over time, all the data products in our intelligence platform will have this quantum sidecar that is coming with it and bringing all the value, all the discoverability, all the observability attached to it. Okay, but we could not say, hey, wait for the quantum to be completely finalized and the mesh to be finalized before we are delivering something of value to our consumers. Otherwise they say, hey, I still need to do my work, right? So that's how we organize the teams to make sure that, you know, we constantly deliver value.
Yeah. And I think that's important. I think this is where I think Jamak is using the phrase data product made it so that people could understand a little bit, but it also muddied the water. We've talked about this in private, because there is so many definitions of the phrase data product, and data as a product thinking is like the data quantum is a manifestation of your data as a product thinking. It's exactly. not the only aspect of data as a product thinking.
Yes, yes, exactly. You can have a data product without the mesh, okay, or without the quantum, or any. It's a product made of data, right? But I think it's coming back to more value you're adding, okay? If you're just delivering data, you're not delivering a lot of trust, right? Hey, where's this data coming from? What is it made of? How often is it refreshed? What's a retention period? So then you start adding stuff like, I'm adding a data contract on top of it. Then, oh, okay, I see a little bit more of trust gaining there. And then you add more, I would say, more sophisticated methods like the data quantum with its observability, with its permanent monitoring of the data. We even add a Amazon-like rating on the data, which is system-powered. So you know, it's basically a data quality index. Okay, and it's not rocket science, but the thing is, it's fun. It gives the user something that, oh, okay, my it's a 5-star data product compared to this crappy 1-star data product that I can find on bargain website, you know. So yeah.
It's the wish.com version of a data product. I don't know if you've seen the wish.com version of things.
Well, I'll try to say politically correct. Being French is sometimes very difficult, but anyway. I think that's one key thing, is it's really bringing trust. Okay, and I'm not saying that there was no trust, but I think it's trust can only improve over time. And all this is iteration over iteration over iteration. So the consumer of the data should feel really like, oh, this is getting somewhere.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is, it's not that the data wasn't trustable, but it's that, you know, because it was like high quality previously in a lot of instances, but somebody still had to go and really do the legwork themselves, the consumer, to see how can I trust this. What can I try in what way, versus with the proper observability metrics and things like that, that you're putting in front of somebody, you give them the capability to say, this is how you can trust it and in what way, right? Yep. If a data product doesn't need completeness, it's like, oh, well, this only has, you know, this level of completeness. Does that make it all of a sudden a bad data product that you can't trust? No, because they're not trying to, you know, they're trying to say, oh, we're hitting it with a 5-minute SLA, and we're really, really focused on accuracy or whatever. And that you have the communications to not just say, this is, you know, 99% accuracy in every single quality metric, versus like, no, this is optimized for this. If you need it optimized for another thing, come have a conversation with us. We may have to create a different data product, or we may have to do that. But like, and having that adult conversation about what are the compromises, right? Historically, we have thought about data as being, you know, 99.9% every quality metric. And yeah, it's just not feasible. It's not doable. It's too expensive. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make business sense. And so we need to have that higher level of communication around, what is this actually like? What are we trying to achieve with this, and how did we achieve it?
No, you're totally right, and that's why one of the thing we invested most time on is really, and from the ground up, is really this idea of a data contract. Okay, and I think it was not a revelation, but it has become something like, okay, this policy, this metadata, this rule, this whatever is going into this data contract, okay? And then, of course, I'm giving you my data contract. You would probably understand it. A data scientist would probably understand it, but it's a, you know, it's code level, okay? So you've got to dig into that. So by providing APIs that are making it easier to consume your data contract, I think this is one of the win.
I have a question that's going to sound like a weird question because I don't think it's been asked, but I think it's something we need to get more explicit about, which is when you're putting out a data quantum, you have this data contract, right? Are you putting out your own, you know, are you telling that people that are creating it to kind of agree to a contract without a specific consumer that is saying these are the contractual obligations that I need so that somebody can box themselves in and say, we're going to update this every hour. And you go and you talk to every, you know, a freshness or a timeliness SLA of an hour. And you go and you talk to all the consumers and they're like, well, we just need this to be within a week, right? We don't need it to be within an hour. And like, how are you setting that up so that, and that consumers can request like slightly different changes or slightly different aspects to those contracts as well?
We are also, our group is at a very special place where we are not producer of data and we're not consumer of data. So I like to see us a little bit like logisticians. And because we are at this place, it's more like, Scott, you want our data? I mean, it's 7 days old and that's it. Okay. If you don't like it, find someone else. Okay. And that's making things a little bit easier on us. Okay. I'm thinking that the discussion will probably evolve to what you're saying. Okay. So, hey, I don't want 3 hours old data. I want 2 minutes old data. But because we have the data contract, we've got something a basis for something we can talk on, right? Otherwise it's random. Okay. And I've seen that in many scenarios where, how fresh is your data? What's data freshness anyway? So this kind of right now we are free from this discussion because we've got metrics, we've got a data contract, we've got SLAs and SLOs that are built in directly the quantum. So that's where you keep, you know, going back to trust. We keep going back to trust. Okay, so hey, our data are trustworthy within these parameters.
Well, and I think this is, especially getting the data, centralized data team out of the conversations and having the consumers and producers talk to each other. Part of that is saying, okay, we're going to go in and we're going to talk about this is the starting point and we're going to have a discussion. Producers, exactly. You're not going to say no to everything. Consumers, you're going to stop asking for the world. Get specific. We, you know, we need this data. We need real time. Okay. Why do you need real time? What does that mean? Oh, well, we're just sick of having it on a 48 hour delay. We need it within 2 hours. Then you don't freaking need real time, but like we need to get into those high context exchanges because it's so crucial to actually, you know, head down that path. And kind of what you talked about, this is something that I'm telling people, around their governance side, people, you know, I say kind of CYA on governance, cover your butt, around governance, around don't get yourself into compliance issues. But the other aspects should be driving towards trust, right? And so that means definitions around what, like, how are we actually measuring what the quality metrics are, right? And it's not that we're standardizing what quality metrics every data quantum has to work with, but we're saying like, this is how you measure it so people can actually understand and figure out what they can trust. And I do think we want to create relatively loose quality standards that are the kind of template. So people can go, oh, if I'm putting out a data quantum, okay, here's what I'm going to put out. If I'm putting it out without having a direct conversation with the consumer, but I'm also like, sorry, just kind of talking at it and circling this back into a lot of the other conversations. But I think that also hits on the point of, are you working with producers to put data into a quantum onto the mesh and then see who consumes it? Or are you having a direct use case first? Or like, how is that actually coming about?
It's always use case driven. Okay. But it doesn't mean, so I would say that, you know, in traditional data engineering, you know, you start by the use case, and because you start by the use case, you're designing your data store based on that, or you're just replicating what the producer is doing and say to the consumer, manage yourself. Okay. So where we add value is really at creating the interoperable model at the center of the quantum itself. Okay. So it's not like because the data is coming in one shape that we need to keep this shape. Okay. And true, we listen to our consumer. And I think we probably listen to our consumer more than we actually listen to the producers. You know, someone is flipping the bill at some point. But it also doesn't mean that, hey, I want this field in red and this one in blue, and I want this constraint that does this and this thing that we're listening. Okay. We've got enough experience to kind of extrapolate a little bit things, and we've got this product mindset that we're bringing to the table as well. Okay. So it's not like, it's not your waterfall data engineering scenario. We've got my specs of what I need to be delivering. It's more like, okay, let's talk to our customers, have this discussion, build user stories around the data, build lifecycle around the data product. Okay. I think one of the key thing, which we've not delivered it yet, but it's built in from day one, is the ability to have multiple data sets. So one strict rule we said is one data quantum equal one domain. Okay. The definition of a domain is very often flexible, but that's a rule we're not going to change. Okay. So one data quantum equal one domain. But inside each data quantum, there's a data is divided in data sets, okay? And there's really a S at the end of data sets. So for us, a data quantum can have multiple data sets, and they also have different versions. So because, and that's going back to being able to trust, okay? We want to make sure that our consumer, the data can be extended, can be enhanced as a data product. Okay. Really the product itself as this life cycle. But additionally, they know that they're relying. Okay. So if you're saying, hey, I need this data set in version 2 and I want it for, you know, ever, that's fine. Okay. Then if we come with a version 3, we can come with a path to upgrade, but they can cohabit for quite a few times. And that's built directly in the mechanism of the data quantum.
So I want to make sure that I understood when you were saying each data quantum is for one domain. Is that a direct one-to-one mapping? Because what a lot of things have been is that each domain may have, you know, one data quantum cannot span multiple domains, but each domain can have multiple data quantums or quanta, right? So are you saying that for each domain, you're at least where you're starting out is that you have one quantum, and it may be kind of the general concept of what other people have looked at as having multiple quantums, because you have multiple data sets within that, but it's just easier to organize it as a single quantum instead of a lot of different quanta?
So far it's really a very strict one to one, okay? And our estimate, our planning on delivering, we think that we're going to have something like 25 quanta by the end of the year, okay? Probably more, but that's to give you a kind of scale. So far on the analysis we did on DOOs, there's no, it's really a one-to-one. It's not like a one-to-one in one direction and a one-to-n in the other direction. Okay. So we define the domains as pretty strict. Okay. So, we've got this pile of data. It's really corresponding to this domain. And that's a quantum where we see where we see when we need to go cross domain or when we need to have more, I would say, either completely cross domain, like let's say finance and fraud or HR and finance or whatever. Okay. If we had to do that, it's possible, but that's where we see a lot of value in the mesh. Okay. It's really when you're starting to mesh stuff together So those quanta will bring additional value.
Yeah, I haven't developed it very completely, but that's kind of plays into the SCAE, which is Scott's confusing ass equation. And that's because I think the way that you're thinking about it with your quantum makes it easier to manage at the holistic level. But I wouldn't be surprised if you start to split out smaller quanta in each domain, or if you say each, unless you're defining each domain as a two pizza team, because like at the end of the day, exactly what you're talking about of the value of the mesh in the long run is about the ability to combine the data across mm-hmm. the different quanta. The quanta themselves have to each have value in and of themselves. This has been something Jamak has talked about a lot. And I think it's good because otherwise you've got these bridging solutions where you're just like, oh, I'm just doing this thing to feed another thing that has value instead of it has value in and of itself. But like if each quantum is worth like one value point and each like good bridging point to another quantum is worth 0.1, well, when you've got two, you've got, you know, 0.1 because there's only one bridge. And you've got one and one, so it's the data quantums are the data quanta are the ones that have the value. But once you get to 10, once you get to 20, once you get to 50 or 100 or whatever, those bridges end up being far more valuable than each individual data quantum or even the whole set of the data quantums in and of themselves. So, I think that's a really interesting take on it. And I think how big are your domains? Is there, because is it the two pizza team domain or is it like you're saying you've got 50, 100 person domain as one problem?
It depends when you look at it, whether it's about building it or it's about using it. Okay. So some of our data products are used by a lot of people. Okay. Like mm-hmm. really, we've got mailing lists of lots of people using them. On the development part, we try to stick to the PISA team. Okay. So going back to Agile. And remember, we're not producing the data. Okay. So it's easier in a little bit for us to be able to do this way.
Okay. Well, and that's where I had Bjorn Smedman on at Cinch, and their domains at the high level of a concept of a domain, they each have 500 plus people in them. Right. So, if you're like, you have one, a single quantum for a 500 person domain, then you're overloading it with a ton of things. But I think it makes a lot of sense what you're talking about. And that's why I think like the terminology, the more that I've dug into the terminology around data, we're just not very specific in the information exchange, which is hilarious because our whole job is information exchange. And yet the wording we use, and you know, language is difficult, obviously. I'm reading the Foundation series, and they've got this whole thing about how they communicate with gestures and thoughts, and like there's all this like embedded hidden meaning and all this, and it's like, oh, wouldn't that be lovely if we could do that in a data product where you could just have the mental download of what this actually means. But
it's a secret cheat code at baseball, right? So you're totally right. But the thing is, we keep the philosophy of each data quantum delivering value. Okay, we're not having, you know, that's a bit like this enabler story in Agile or something. It has to bring value. Otherwise, it's not. And that's also why we know that we're going to end up with a lot of them. Okay. Often when I'm comparing, when I'm explaining that to, you know, younger engineers or coming to our world, it's almost like a quantum is a table, okay? And when you mesh it, it's when you have a relation between two tables. And so you can imagine that a company like ours, there's a lot of tables. So down the road, how many quantum are we going to have? It's going to be an interesting view. But going back to that is really about how can I control, and that's why we've got this control plane, okay, in every quantum. How can I control the behavior of the quantum and to make sure that I don't have an army of ops people maintaining them, okay? It's really like that's the next thing, okay? And then at the mesh level, we will have these similar APIs as well to make sure that we can control all that from a more central place, at least for the ops perspective. But when you've got this very regular, standardized, documented, life-cycled APIs, it makes your life a lot easier to build whatever you want, okay? And it's an API first approach we have, okay? We don't look at implement something and then we decide, oh, that would be nice to have an API on top of this thing. It's really, we're thinking about, okay, this is the API we want to look at the API. And then, of course, the API has to serve a purpose. But the thing is, we look at that, design it, establish a contract, and then we can build both the servers and the client part. And yeah, so that's how we've been implementing it, and so far so good.
So here's where I'm a little bit struggling is that there's about 17 topics again we could go into that I think would be very useful for the audience. But I think let's start with you kind of described some of the API stuff in this call and in your blog post. But like, if somebody is getting started, what would you tell them were some missteps that you took, or what were some things around, like, if they want to do an API first approach, which I think makes the most sense, like, how do you start looking at building analytical APIs that work? Like, how do you do that so that somebody who's like, okay, I'm bought in, I want to do the JGP method, how do I do that? Like, what are some things that you've learned, or what are some things that you think that people need to be aware of?
Yeah, so it's really about the do's and don'ts about APIs. Okay, so we've got really, if I'm not talking about APIs, but when you look at our lovely hexagon, okay, we see several ways that this IO block, this IO full of hexagon, okay? You've got your data sources on the left, you've got your data consumers on the right, and you've got all these APIs for bringing the additional values, okay? So we've got the control APIs, okay, so all this control plane, we've got the observability APIs, and we've got the discovery APIs, okay? So that's really, I would say, I know that some people don't like the term of metadata anymore, but that's really the delivering all the meta level of information regarding your quantum and the control of it. Okay, so, and I think this is really useful. You're not accessing any of the data that is inside. You're accessing data, but not the operational data you want to have access to or the analytical data. That's really something you can access via the two ports. Okay, so I would say the analytic port and the operational port, and you can access that. You can get the information via the dictionary API over to know how to access it. But the thing is, we're not, and that's a real big don't, we're not building an API that says, hey, give me the first 100 records that matches first name equals Scott. Okay, that's for me, that's kind of a little bit insane to think this way. I know that some people are thinking about that. Or ask your quantum to take all this data and put it on a Kafka topic. I think that's not what we're doing. I think that would be extremely dangerous. It would add latency to your data. And nobody needs additional latency.
Well, I think that's in the long run where we need to go. I honestly believe that. I think Chris Riccomini has talked about this. The more that I talk to people, the more that's in the long run where we need to go. But right now we have no idea how to do that efficiently and intelligently and all of that. And so we need something like Istio and Kong and like all these things that have happened in the service mesh side to make it so we can have API management. If we're going to do API-based access to the actual information to pull that in an appropriate way, you can't have a paginated API call of exactly what you said of, okay, I need you to run this filter query for me via the API, because if you're not pulling more than one or two things, right, like you'd have as kind of a data access API on the operational side of, you know, I'm this person is trying to order, what is their shipping address, right? Like that's a thing of, okay, I just need to pull this one piece of data. But if we're trying to pull, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions, billions of rows at once, you can't have it pulling one at a time. You can't have it, you know, doing the filter each time of what's the next one? What have I already pulled? What have I already pushed in? It just, you know, your query ends up in a ridiculous state. But I do think we need to figure out where we can go with those APIs. But I think what you said is a good thing for people to feel comfortable that they're not way behind the ball, that they're not way, way behind everyone else, of you saying like, don't do these analytical APIs because we don't know how to do them yet, right?
Well, I didn't say we don't know how to do them. I said, don't do it this way. We might know how to do some of that, and we'll probably share that later. But I think it's really coming back to seeing the data quantum as a database, okay, or as a table. You're not going to build an API on top of a table, right? I mean, just for analytical purpose. Of course, but the thing is, we're not, and I really find that was kind of a very refreshing thing when I read that in Jean-Marc's book. Okay, that it's okay to think that the same container of data, call it whatever, but as this analytical access and this operational access. Okay, so I think this is pretty fantastic that finally someone has the guts to put it in a book and say it's okay, you know, and because a lot of a lot of people are still convinced that there's two worlds. There's the operational world and there's the analytical world. I would even push it to say that the operational world can be read-write and not only read-only. I know. I'm opening a can of worm here. But I think it's really the way you're going to handle and treat your data. I think it's all possible. It's you've got to think about it, but it's all possible.
I do think there are very separate worlds when you think about what are you actually trying to accomplish in that. Not that the data is separate, not that the information is separate, but like there are analytical workloads and there are operational workloads, right? When you have an operational workload, it's I'm interacting with somebody live, right? And analytical queries can be operational workloads, but like we need to, within Data Mesh, we need to set ourselves up that we can actually make our analytical workloads, like somebody actually asking questions and doing queries and doing that stuff, is a first-class citizen. But you also can't be in the path that's going to slow down where that analytical question being asked is going to slow down somebody that's clicking around on your website, right? Like, so it's you can't have that. But outside of that, yeah, absolutely. There's no reason that a certain set of data is operational or analytical. And operational systems should be pulling data from the data mesh. They absolutely should be getting that information. It's just not if they have a live interaction where the speed is measured in milliseconds, that's got to go all the way to the data mesh and then it's got to run this and then push it back into the thing. So, but yes, it becomes this huge can of worms having that conversation because everybody wants to define operational and analytical. And then it's, have you ever seen that proof of proving 1 + 1 = 2? It's a 17-page proof. I believe that's the number. Right? Somebody tried to prove mathematically that 1 + 1 = 2. And at some point you just kind of have to go, let's not do that. Like let's think about there's operational and there's analytical, and we know kind of what that means, but that we don't have to think about this stuff is so separate and these worlds are hardened off from each other, and that you can only communicate over this very, very Byzantine way of approaching each other. This information needs to flow freely back and forth, but we can't also have analytical queries that are slowing down our operational actual transactions.
Right. No, I'm with you there. Okay. I'm totally with you there. But the fact that having a data store that can behave and support both world is doable. Okay. And that's one of the, it's not the only, but that was kind of one of the wow moments when reading, you know, Jean-Marc's book. Okay. So it's not taboo anymore. Okay. I've been in a lot of companies where just mentioning that and you almost get kicked out of a meeting or, you know, or your job or whatever. but I'm not saying that it should be always the case, but we've got some use cases where it makes sense to combine them. And I'm not saying they're going to be easy to solve, but it makes sense. Okay. You've got an army of data scientists working on, you know, thresholds and things like that. And you've got all the people that wants to consume that record by record. So you've got, you cannot tell them, okay, I'm going to double that. And then your data is not probably in sync and all those things. So that's where it makes sense to see the quantum as this facility. Is every quantum going, you know, and it's also a thing, and that's why we heavily rely on our data contract is every quantum going to have the same features? Hell no. Okay. I mean, it's not going to happen. We've got a provision for specific behaviors in some quantum as well. Okay. So because there's specific scenarios, use case, whatever you want to call them, that calls for that.
Well, and I've talked about this a little bit in the past of local maximization versus global maximization of value. And like we're trying to not have go for the data warehouse with the single schema and, you know, all that stuff like that. You're like, okay, I've got my schema for this. And so it's a cookie cutter. So everything now looks like a dinosaur because you've got a dinosaur cookie cutter. So this thing that was a fern, you cut off all of the things around it. And so now it looks like a dinosaur and it was a fern. And so, I think a lot of what you're talking about, it just at the end of the day, we have to, but we do also have to think about you're talking about, at your control plane and I almost think we're going to see an interoperability plane that kind of even replaces the control plane aspect and all of that, because we're going to need more and more interoperability focus, but we also need to be able to maximize the context locally. And so how do we do that? And a lot of what you're talking about is I work at DataStax and I'm trying to push them to push Cassandra and their AstroDB, which is, you know, a serverless version of Cassandra offering to do this, right? Exactly what you're talking about, where, you know, what used to happen was you do your analytical queries against your operational system between, you know, midnight and 5 a.m. And if it didn't run, if it didn't get it through, you were too screwed, late. Right?
Yeah.
But that was your only window. We don't have that with a global world. We don't have that like local window even to do that. So we've had to separate these systems in such a way that doesn't really, if we don't have to, it doesn't make any sense to. So I hope we can get there, but
. Yeah, I think we'll get there. I think, you know, this will movement, okay, around data mesh has opened the gate, okay, so to a lot of things, and I would even say and almost challenge you in a duel, you know, on a lot of your episodes you were saying that the data mesh is not for everybody. I'm almost saying that the data mesh is for everybody from a certain size, okay, when you're thinking that if database vendors, let's say DataStax or IBM or whoever, starts to implement mesh features, okay, or quantum level features with the database and the data management solution, why not? You know, we're only at the beginning of that. It's like if you went through this exercise of, hey, JDBC, when JDBC was invented, I don't know if it's the first version, but soon after, they have all this access to the metadata, and it opened a whole new thing. So with Java, you could access to the metadata in a standard way for your applications, okay? And I remember that it was great for Java-based frameworks because the frameworks could abstract a few things from that, and things like Hibernate and all those things were greatly profited from that kind of access to the data. And it forced vendors to adhere to a standard, okay, where before that it was kind of, if you want to know the name of the tables I'm supporting, you've got to access this system table somewhere, right? So you could see the evolution of that in the traditional RDBMS world. First of all, the world is not RDBMS anymore, or RDBMS centric anymore. But it's also that, hey, if we come with, whether it's a community or some vendors coming with standards that can be approved by many, well, why not have this kind of, this data contract, and the data contract is directly bundled with the data source, okay? So it can access and it can be consumed by quantum or other data storage solution directly because it's an open standard. Okay.
Yeah. And that's where I'm hoping we can get to a thing where right now, talking with everybody, like so many aspects of data mesh are very, very manual and everybody's having to invent things themselves, not even being able to see examples. So like you putting out an example, I saw one that came out where somebody said, and here's our data contract. And it was all in code. And it was like 4 pages of me scrolling down this data contract. But that's super helpful. Right. I have no idea if it's any good because I'm not at that level where I can assess if it's any good of a data contract. But like that we can get more examples out there of how people are doing this, because exactly what you're talking about, so much of the stuff that we're doing is one-off, right? And we that includes the systems, right? That includes, okay, why do we have to have, I keep talking about with people about DuckDB. I'm really excited about DuckDB because within the application, you can have your OLAP, right? You don't have to go out to Spark and do your processing and come back in, right? That you've got that capability to, within your application, literally do your analytical things instead of having this round trip. And I think we need to really think about how can we do that stuff much more? I don't know, but, I know we're a little bit over time as well. I know you've got to hop here, but again, we could probably talk for another hour and a half, 2 hours at least on a lot of this.
At least.
is there anything we didn't cover that you think we should have, or is there any kind of way you want to wrap it up, or any advice that you'd give to people? Is it just come talk to you and you've got all the answers for them, or what is the thing that you tell people trying to look forward?
I don't have all the answers by far. That would be pretty arrogant. I can be sometimes. I think we one thing we didn't talk about is open source. I'm not saying I wish we talked about open source because it would be put me in a weird position. As a follow up, I'm giving a data mesh talk about how we can build a data mesh with open source, and that's going to be at All Things Open in early November in Raleigh, and a great conference from my friend there. So I would, if you're in the Raleigh area, I would highly recommend that. So that would be something we can have a few sessions on.
and I think we need to get to a place of open sharing where it's not open source software implies continued support versus throw over the wall. I tried to do this with my DataMoss thing, which was Data Mesh OSS, which it's a stupid name, but it's memorable to be like DataMoss. That's a dumb name because it's not even very clever. But we need more people throwing over like actual code examples, or here is how we're handling this thing. And no, we're not going to support it. No, we're not going to do this. But like, here's an actual picture of this, because so much of what we're doing is we're discussing art, right? We're not showing people the picture. Yes. We're discussing the picture, and that we need to get more, but people are like, my code isn't beautiful. And I'm like, I don't care. Nobody cares. You can literally throw it my way. I will put it out on the internet and strip your name out of it if you want that. Right. So that way people can see it. But like, I keep trying to get this with like people's internal events standards, right? Like what are your standards for storing X or Y or Z so that everything adheres to the same standards, so you have that interoperability? Nobody's even willing to share that because they're like, it's not beautiful. And it's like, we gotta be able to have a community where you can be vulnerable, where you can share something that's not polished. And that not polished means that somebody doesn't have to go and invent cloth, right? They don't have to go and invent fiber and, you know, well, not invent, but you know what I mean? Like discover and start to figure out how to weave and all that stuff, versus you can show somebody, here's some fibers, here's how we weaved it. You know, our loom really sucks, but you know, we're heading down that path, and that people can go, oh, I don't have to completely rethink this entirely in my own head. Like, that's what, where I want to get to, but we're just not there yet. And it's okay. But
yeah. And I think your show is where people can show a little bit of vulnerability. You know, you don't have to go through legal to go to a podcast. So that makes a difference. I think that's coming there, okay? And it's you've done an impressive job, like, you know, in less than a year of running the show, you've got, I don't know, 157 episodes so far or something. So I think that's where you can highlight the community, and honestly, the Slack group which you run has been really helpful as well. Okay, so true, people are not sharing much there, but it's coming. I'm pretty sure it will come. Okay, it's also, you know, it's also something that because the concept has been coming not from a software vendor, but more from a service company. It's more difficult to get the software vendor, because if let's imagine it was Red Hat doing the data mesh and everybody, oh, it's open source, it's great, and etc. It's easy to go code there, okay? But then it's also very limitative, because then it's going to be kind of controlled by a company and a vendor. Here, it's more of a community guided by a few people. But the thing is, yeah, maybe they should share a little bit of the work they're doing as well with some of their customers.
Yeah, I've been trying to get the vendors to participate in a way where they're not selling, and they just can't understand that mode of, hey, if you go out to your customers that are using you for data mesh and you tell their story, then you're attached to data mesh and you keep getting brought up in every conversation around data mesh. Like, why aren't you spending the effort to extract this from them? But yeah, exactly. And I'm trying to create a space which hasn't been the case in data. You know, data, we've been about, is this right or is this wrong? Is this a one or a zero? And it's not, is this the information? And so I still haven't been able to create a space where people can be very vulnerable and be like, hey, here's my idea. What do people think? And then people are like, that's stupid, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, we have to be in such a way where it's like, hey, I think these are some things that you're missing, but I really like X, Y, you know, A, B, and C, but I think you might be missing X and Y, and Z could be a problem, but maybe not. And we just need to. And so I think those conversations are happening behind closed doors, and the Slack is a good way to find those people to have those conversations. But still,
it also makes sense. Okay, who's doing data mesh? Okay, it's not a startup around the corner. Okay, it's larger companies for now. It's a large company problem to solve. Large company means, you know, legal departments. So nobody wants to have his but, you know, offered. I guess that some of the companies will probably work more into opening more stuff. Okay. I got a blog post about data mesh at PayPal. I'd say maybe things will change. Okay.
I've thought about doing the interviews where it's like the black outline and we change people's voices and be like, tell me your anti-patterns. Like, because that could be really funny, but it could also be like, no, like, tell me, like, you can be honest here because nobody knows who you are and that.
This is how we solved all the problems, by doing kind of things. Yeah.
Yeah. But more of like the vulnerability side of like, you can hide who is actually telling it. But well, again, JGP, this has been so phenomenal. I'm sure there's going to be tons and tons of people that want to follow up with you. Where's the best place? What do you want people following up about? People LinkedIn, or is there another place, or your website, or anything like that?
So I'd love to have more followers on Twitter, but it's really, I'm not successful at that. So I think it's going to be LinkedIn once more. Okay. So, I've got teenager kids, so we're not comparing the number of followers we've got on YouTube, but it's almost there. So LinkedIn's great. If you try to connect with me on LinkedIn, just say that you're coming from, you know, the show that you've listened. I've got so many anonymous just people just wanted to connect, and honestly, I'm not opening my door to, you know, anybody. So at least say something, say hi, you know, in the message you're sending to when you connect. So that's great. And really topics I'd love to discuss with people is really data contracts, APIs, open source. So that's really things which are dear to my heart. And of course, I'm not every day on Slack. But on your Slack, I'm on every day on Slack, but not on the data mesh learning community Slack. But I'm going there very regularly. So, and it's easy to poke me at JGP. So
I'm not, on there every day anymore either. Like I think we all need to have, some breaks from it and stuff, but I think I'm trying to encourage more people to do that. But, well, JGP, again, thank you so much for your time today. And also thank you everyone out there for listening.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Scott, for managing this thing. It's a great piece of work. I love it. My time on the mower is really much better. And I'm kind of looking forward to more episodes on learning more about data mesh and people's experience. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for having me today.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Jean-Jour Perry, or JGP, the intelligence platform lead at PayPal. You can find a link to his LinkedIn, website, Twitter, the blog post we discussed, his YouTube, and his upcoming talk at All Things Open, which has a free virtual registration if you're interested, in the show notes as per usual. Thank you. Thanks everyone for listening to another great guest on the Data Mesh Learning Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, especially DataStax, who actually pays for me full-time to help out the data mesh community. If you're looking for a scalable, extremely cost-efficient, multi-data center, multi-cloud database offering and or an easy-to-scale data streaming offering, check DataStax out. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with me, there's links in the show notes to go ahead and reach out. I would love to hear more about what you're doing with Data Mesh and how I can be helpful. So please do reach out and let me know, as well as if you'd like to be a guest. Check out the show notes for more information. Thanks so much.